Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're this hour going to talk about food production in our world. You know that organic food production is all the rage. But can we really feed the world that way? We hear the word sustainable. Does it really work? Because most of our food now comes from large industrial factory farms. And we're going to talk about all that in the course of this hour. I'll introduce my guest to you and we'll get started with this. But first, I want to remind you that support for the WEAA traffic report is provided by Home Depot, offering plant care guides at HomeDepotGardenClub.com.
On and off slowing, Interloop, Charles Street to Lockraven Boulevard with this update on the roads brought to you by Caltrade. Some heavy spots along the way, 95 northbound, 895 merge to White Marsh Boulevard. Also heavy, JFX northbound, Guilford to Cold Spring. Crash in the city, Warwick at Fayette. Anne Arundel County, a couple problems there. An accident east-west Boulevard at Woodland Road. And a disabled vehicle 50 eastbound at Davidsonville Road. Caltrade, get a little TLC every day. Tender loving Caltrade. Caltrade has essential daily calcium, plus advanced levels of vitamin D to help you absorb that TLC. I'm Joanna Campbell with Baltimore Area Traffic.
And thank you, Joanna Campbell. I hope that makes your ride just a little bit easier on the way home. But on the way home now, it is getting close to dinner time. And getting close to dinner time means that you're putting food on the table and food in the oven and getting ready to cook it up. But the question is, what kind of food is that? Now, a lot of people, all the rage in America and around the world, especially in the Western world, is organic food, food we call sustainable. But what does that really mean? The majority of the world gets its food from large, much of the Western world at any rate, especially the United States of America, we get our food from large industrial-based farms. There are no longer farms where our cows and cattle just roam the range. They are feedlots. There are mass production of food that we get from across the country. So it takes a lot of carbon fuel to get the food to us. So is sustainable food and organic food and food grown within our communities and close to our communities the way the future is going? Or do we have to be more realistic about how we produce food for the world? We're going to talk about that in all its complexity this hour with our guests. Joining me in the studio is Dr. Robert Lawrence, who is director of the Center for a Livable Future at the Johns Hopkins University School, Bloomberg School of Public Health. And joining us by ISCN is Dr. Pamela Ronald, who is a plant pathologist at the University of California, Davis. With her husband, an organic farmer, she wrote the book. Interesting. This is a brand new notion to me until I got to study this show, but for this show, Tomorrow's Table, Organic Farming, Genetics, and the Future of Food. We'll discuss that marriage in a bit. And Bob Young, who's economist at the American Farm Bureau, the largest farm organization in the United States that works to protect the interests of farmers and ranchers, and Drs. Robert Lawrence, Pamela Ronald, and Bob Young. Welcome. Good to have all three of you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Thank you so much. This is a really fascinating discussion because we hear so much about sustainability being the watchword of the future. And by the way, this is live, folks. You can join us at 410-319-8888. The other week we had a show about urban agriculture and the future of that in cities like Baltimore and other cities around the country. But can that really feed all the people? There's a question I constantly ask every person who comes on this program to talk about sustainable agriculture is, can farmers actually make a living by letting their chickens run free and having a multi-use farm that rotates crops and livestock? Is that really feasible for the world? And many people would argue it's not. But let's talk about the state of our world, food production, what is feasible and what is not when it comes to thinking about sustainability and how we feed ourselves as a species. And let me let the three of you for just a moment outline the issue as you see it. And we'll start with Bob Young, who is an economist at the American Farm Bureau. Bob?
Well, it's good to be on the program.
Good to have you with us.
And, you know, one thing I would say is that, there's a number of different definitions of sustainability, and we probably need to talk about that at least a little bit. You know, we've got any number of our members that are fourth, fifth, and sixth generation of farmers on the same land. And so I think if you were to sit down and talk to them, they'd say they're a pretty sustainable operation. But I think once you get beyond that, you know, probably the most important sustainability is to make sure that we've got economic sustainability, you know, because if you don't have that, you really don't have much of anything else. The other thing we need to think about as well is that, you know, kind of almost regardless of what kind of production system you're talking about, you need to make sure you're talking about a crop system that provides for the nutrient requirements of the plant, that controls for the weeds that are going to also compete for those same nutrients and water, as well as make sure that you're taking care of the bugs. You know, and it really kind of gets down to those three things. And whether it's production or conventional production agriculture or organic agriculture, both of those operations or both of those approaches to farming provide for all three of those. They just do it in very different ways. You know, we'll talk about using chemicals or genetic engineering in traditional row crop to work on taking care of the bugs. Many of that same kind of BT practice also gets used in organic agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
We worry about making sure we've got nitrogen on the field for the corn to grow, for example. We do it with animal manure or that type of approach in organic agriculture. So, you've got to make sure you're taking care of those three basic things.
And the definition of organic and sustainable is a very confusing subject.
Well, actually, the definition of organic, I mean, we have national standards for what organic production happens to be, and there's a pretty defined list of what chemicals that you can use in organic production. They're not synthetic chemicals. They're natural chemicals, but a fairly defined list of chemicals that can be used.
Bob Lawrence, let me ask you to kind of take a stab at this, because, I mean, you're the Center for Livable Future at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. Is trying to think of different ways for where we get our food, and so when I said to Bob Young a moment ago that the definition of organic is very difficult, because I talked to a chicken farmer, somebody who works in farm, the other day, and they said to me, "Well, look, here's the reality. The reality is, yes, my neighbor can sell his chickens as free range, but what does that mean? That means you raise these chicks, you put them in a barn for 6 weeks to let them mature." And then you open the door. But, of course, chickens get acculturated very early in their life, so they never leave. And they have a giant pen, but they don't use it. But still, we can call them free-range chicken. So, I mean, the definition of free-range and organic is a very mutable subject, it seems to me.
It is, and lots of people are gaming the system. But I want to step back, Mark, and say that our current agricultural system is not sustainable. It's not meeting the needs of the world's people. We have 6.8 billion people globally. Over a billion of them are malnourished. We've probably had another 60 to 80 million people in the last year alone slip into a point where their disposable income, even if they spent all of it on food, would not be sufficient to feed their family. So we're post peak water, we're post-peak oil, and with global climate change, we may be post-peak arable soil. So the current system is not going to carry us much further. In fact, it's not currently meeting the needs of the world's population.
So it'd be your argument, before we turn to Pamela Ronald, it'd be your argument that the industrial farms that we have today, the large farming conglomerates we have today that feed most of the people of the United States of America and beyond, and those farms also exist in Chile and other places that feed much of the world, aren't sustainable.
That's right. Let me give you just one quick example. The Amazon basin gets 16% of the hydrologic cycle. It only has 1% of the world's population. China, the northern China Plain, where the water table is now disappearing at about 20 centimeters a year, is their breadbasket. They can no longer raise enough grain to avoid importing from the world market. Second, the Chinese people, with about 21% of the world's population, are eating about 46% of the world's pork. So how do they feed the pigs? They import soybeans from at the Amazon basin. So we're clearing tropical rainforest in order to take the soybeans grown in that land and ship to China in place of shipping water, because it takes about 1,000 tons of water to produce a ton of grain. So the whole global system right now is so fragile. The shocks of last year with the Australian drought, the dramatic increase in fossil fuel, we saw corn going to $7, $8 a bushel in the United States. gas ethanol, which has been a travesty in terms of efficient use of row crops, all of this conspired to drive millions more people into hunger around the world. So the system is broken, and we need to fix it, and we need to fix it with more responsible use of resources, cutting back on the enormous investment that it takes to produce the amount of meat that we eat. That's one big, big area where we could make substantial gains in food security.
We can't mandate being a vegetarian, but let me come back to all some of the issues you've raised and first turn to Dr. Pamela Ronald. And I'm really fascinated by your look at this because I was going to raise in a little bit that Vaclav Smil, who's an environmental scientist at the University of Manitoba, said that if we were to try to feed 6.7 billion people on this planet with organic methods and methods that rotate crops and rotate animal systems that have manure and then move them off the next year and have crops be there instead, that we'd have to tear down the rainforest to do it because we don't have enough land to do it in that in an organic way. And I'm curious, Pamela Ronald, where you think we should be going?
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here with the other guests. I think that the issues that were raised by the other guests are absolutely valid, that we do not have a sustainable food system now, and we need to feed more people, and we need to do it in an environmentally responsible manner. And so what it's important to recognize is two things about organic. Definitely organic has contributed to raising the public awareness of the need for more ecologically based farming system. But it's also important to realize that organic farming now constitutes only 2% of the agriculture in the United States and even less worldwide.
Right.
So we really need to move the other 98% towards more sustainability. And organic farming itself, the definition of organic farming is not to be equated with sustainability. So in the National Organic Program standards, those standards are really focused on reducing environmental inputs, which is very important, but there is not a requirement that there be sustainability in terms of land use. So what my husband and I have, so he's an organic farmer and I'm a geneticist, and it turns out it's relatively uncommon for a geneticist to be married to an organic farmer. And we,
it's a mixed
over
marriage,
years,
it sounds like to me.
Well, we have, many of our friends and family really see genetic engineering and organic farming as representing polar opposites of
right.
the agricultural industry, and we've often been asked how we reconcile these types of ideas. And many of our scientific colleagues have asked us to explain why many people in the organic farming community oppose genetic engineering. So that's really why we wrote the book. It's really in response to those questions. And it's not that difficult for us. We've always had the same goal, which is an ecologically based system of agriculture. And perhaps not surprisingly, we think of our professions as having something to contribute.
Now, I do want to explore in the course of this hour, Pamela, how this marries itself, because it's literally the first time I thought or heard about the idea of genetically modified plants and organic farming as something that could be used to create large farms and large amounts of food is an absolute anomaly to me at first, and had no understanding of it until I started reading about it in terms of your work. And so that's something we are really going to explore in all this, because I think that it sounds in some ways, and let me just, not to set up a kind of a visceral argument here, but I do want to kind of point out some of the differences. I think that Bob Lawrence and Bob Young, that you have very different ideas about how we should feed the world and where that should come from. And, I mean, if it's true, though, that at the moment only 3%, as Pamela Ronald said, of our farming in this country is organic, and that the argument is made by some that if we wanted to rid the world of synthetic fertilizers and our dietary habits remained the same, that we'd need a lot of extra land to create the need for cover crops or forage to feed animals, to kind of rotate things. And that's a virtual impossibility, and that you could never have enough regional farming or local farming to feed the world, and that I think it's 18% of the carbon going, 19% of the carbon going into our atmosphere, the fossil fuel is used to bring food from one location in America to the next across the country.
Total transportation is 18%.
Right.
Not just for food, but total transportation.
Well,
I think the 18 or 19% you may be thinking of, Mark, is the food and agriculture estimate of the global contribution greenhouse gases of animal husbandry. When you add up the CO2, the methane, and the nitrous oxide, the latter two having much more potent greenhouse heat-trapping effect than CO2.
So the question I have the three of you, and I'll start with you, Bob Lawrence, and then I'll let you, Bob Young, respond to it, and then hear what Pamela Ronald says in response to all of that, is that can we feed the United States of America, let alone the world and the world, in a sustainable way? It sounds to me like it'd be a very hard nut to crack.
Yeah. Well, let me, if I may, go back to 1990 data. Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for developing the high-yield wheat in Mexico that led to the Green Revolution, which some people are now calling the Chemical Revolution because it made us very dependent on fossil fuels and a number of other inputs to the industrial agriculture of today. But Norman Borlaug was asked by the Union of Concerned Scientists to look at 1990 data when we had 5 billion people in the world, and the food production globally was sufficient if it had been equitably distributed and predominantly a form of grains, fruits, and vegetables to feed 6 billion people. We had a billion person margin of safety. However, had the rest of the world wanted to eat the way we were eating in North America and Western Europe,
which they do,
everybody wants to eat that way, there was only enough food produced in 1990 to feed 3.5 billion. So the problem is that it takes 7 tons of grain to produce a ton of beef, 4 tons of grain to produce a ton of pork, 2 tons of grain to produce a ton of poultry. If we moved, and you inserted vegetarian, I'm not going to say we have to all be vegetarians, but the typical American diet now, we derive 65% of our protein from animal sources. Globally, the average is 30%. Even our own Department of Agriculture, in their recommended daily allowances, said we should be eating about a third less meat than we do. So if suddenly you take away that enormous driving force of producing row crops to feed animals before we consume the animals, and we start feeding that grain to people directly, we could make an enormous gain in food security without doing anything to the system other than altering the amount of meat we eat.
So Bobby, one of the arguments that I see, that the subtext here is that the way our foreign policies are in America, they lend themselves for soybean and corn to raise either for fuel or for feed crops for animals or for using in Wesson oil and other things like that, vegetable oil. And that's a real mistake, and we can never turn this around unless we change those policies.
I agree with that.
I think I'd have a serious argument with that. But let's go down this road of even if you were to talk about this reduction in, and this would be a pretty significant reduction in meat consumption, and understand that the rest of the planet really wants to talk about increasing their animal protein consumption. A study that USDA did, and probably the best study that's out there at the moment to look at the difference in yield from organic production versus conventional production. Surveyed about 300 or so organic farmers when they put this together. So again, a pretty good sample size in terms of trying to collect that data. Suggested that the yield for organic soybean production came in at about 31 bushels an acre, as opposed to conventional production at 47 bushels per acre. Now, you know, if you're going to talk about that kind of a yield difference, and even if you were going to talk about that significant reduction in meat consumption that we've already talked about, that still wouldn't make up. You're still going to have to go out and plant more acres to soybeans in order to fill that need. And that's before we talk about increasing consumption in China or India or, you know, you name the country as well that you'd like to in terms of increasing their meat consumption. So I just don't. I think you can make a very strong case that You know, we talk about very significant differences in terms of food prices and things of that nature. I'd also talk about the price of organic soybeans, for example, today, you know, runs about $15 as opposed to, you know, high eights, low nines for conventionally produced soybeans. So, you know, there are some very significant price implications here as well. We do a survey on a nationwide basis of what organic milk prices, for example, are relative to conventional milk prices are. And there you're talking about a difference of almost double for organic milk. So, you know, these are lifestyle choices, and I have no problem with folks making those lifestyle choices, but just understand that there are very definite consequences associated with those choices.
So let me, before I let you come back in here, Rob, to respond, I'd like to take a route with Pamela Ronald and come right back to your thoughts. I mean, so Pamela Ronald, and by the way, the phones are open at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on food production, how we get our food, do we have to change the way we do it? Is it impossible to do large-scale farming? Is it the only way that we can get our food? Perhaps it is. Your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Perhaps I want to buy organic milk, but it does cost twice as much as the milk that I would buy that's non-organic or non free-range milk, and pasteurized milk, I should say. I mean, cows allowed to roam the pasture. I'm not being very clear. But Pamela Ronald, so you heard these arguments. The question is, it seems to me that what I've been reading a little bit about what you all have been talking about is that you think there's a way to create organic food in a mass way that feeds the world.
Yeah, one of the main points of our book is that we really need to look at the broader goals. And the broader goals are to produce safe and nutritious food and to have on-farm economic sustainability, support rural communities, feed the poor and malnourished. Something like 24,000 people die each day from malnutrition. We need to reduce environmental inputs worldwide. There's 300,000 pesticide-related deaths. And we need to protect the genetic diversity. And as one of our guests mentioned, much of the arable land has already been farmed. So we need to produce more food on less land. And we need to do that without using more water, which is another really important issue. And so there are, with organic, it really depends on the crop and the farmer and the location in terms of the yield of organic. But, you know, I generally agree with the guests that organic yields are generally less. So that
right.
means, thank you, Bob Young. And so we really need to enhance yield in order to use our land very efficiently. And I think this is a greater problem as global warming is right now. It's a very serious issue. So what we're arguing in our book is we would like to use the best organic farming practices, but we'd also like to use the best of modern genetics to generate seed that will contribute to the sustainable system. And there are some really excellent examples. We can talk later in the show about genetically engineered crops that have reduced the use of insecticides and pesticides.
Well, let me ask you about that right now, if I might, Pamela Ronald, because one of the great protests going on, especially in Europe, about buying American products was the fact that they were genetically modified agricultural products, and that Europe and other parts of the world didn't want it. And I must say that I had my own kind of knee-jerk first reaction saying, if that's genetically modified food, I want it labeled. I don't want to use it. I don't know how that affects our well-being using genetically modified food. So talk about that in the context of how that changes the nature of agriculture and what it means to have a genetically modified organic food.
Sure. Okay. So it might help to give a background as to what is on our dinner plates now. So all those people going preparing their dinner, there is nothing that they will eat tonight that is not genetically modified. And I say that using the traditional term of genetic modification, which is breeding has led to new varieties, and everything we eat is reliant on those varieties. So it's not that anybody probably in your area is going out and harvesting wild mushrooms and having them for dinner. There's a few lucky few that get to do that, but mostly they are on the dinner table is food that has been modified by human beings. So genetic engineering is a modern form of genetic modification. But it's important to think that right now there's been a cumulative billion acres of genetically engineered crops that have been planted. There hasn't been a single instance of human or environmental health effects. So I should back up and say the difference between genetic engineering and sort of this more conventional approach is that with genetic engineering, you can take a gene from any species and put it into a crop variety, whereas with the conventional approaches, you're generally limited to closely related species. The other major difference is with conventional breeding, breeders mix up large sets of uncharacterized genes, whereas with genetic engineering, you put one or two genes in at a time. And the National Academy of Sciences and other scientific professional organizations have looked at this, and the consensus is that the process of how you introduce your genes is not the key issue, that anytime you introduce new genes, there's some low-level risk. So it doesn't matter if you're introducing genes through conventional breeding or genetic engineering, you are creating something new. The issue really is, are we developing new crops that can help farmers combat disease and help consumers by producing nutritious and safe food?
So Bob Lawrence, I'm really curious about your thoughts on this a little bit and how that feeds into your agreements or disagreements with what Bob Young was saying.
Well, first, I agree with Pamela's basic thesis. I would say that it is not entirely accurate to say that there's not been a single untoward impact of GMOs. We have had the Cornell entomologist document monarch butterfly toxicity from genetic drift of BT corn.
If I could just clarify, that was a laboratory experiment, and when people looked in the field, they found, and this has been widely documented, that genetically engineered crops that use BT have vastly reduced amounts of insect death. So if you compare a conventional field to a genetically engineered field, there's much more destruction of biodiversity on the conventional field. And the reason for that is because conventional growers spray insecticides, which kills almost everything.
Yeah, I agree with that point, Pamela. But it's interesting how our language has evolved. We now talk about conventional to describe industrial agriculture of the last 70 years. The 7,000 years of selection of cultivars and constantly improving the genetic stock of food crops around the world is now called organic. I'd like to see us talk about conventional agriculture as what existed for the first 7,000 years and talk about industrial agriculture as what exists today. One of the concerns that I have about the telescoping in time of selection of cultivars and using genetic engineering to accelerate that pace is just what Pamela points out. There's a risk associated with any plant selection process. But the risks when you're taking the traditional approach of cultivar selection that had dominated agriculture since its origin is that you have this time period of seeing whether or not you're producing an invasive species, what its characteristics in the ecosystem are going to be. Now all of that happens in a matter of weeks or months rather than a matter of years or decades. So a lot of people have proposed the precautionary principle as an important guidepost for evaluating the contribution of genetic engineering. The precautionary principle says unless we can be very, very certain that there is no unintended harm coming from this introduction, we should avoid it because history is filled with examples of unintended consequences.
Well, then when we come back from this break, I want to kind of ask Bob Lawrence, Bob Young, Pamela Ronald, then as we look at a new presidential administration here in the United States of America, the battle over agricultural policy, and whether or not, as I said earlier, and Bob Young was going to talk about this, and we'll let him do that when we come back, whether or not it is, some people would argue, weighted too heavily towards certain kind of crops like soy and corn that go for industrial purposes, that go for feeding animals and more beef production, more pork production, more poultry production, whether we can change that, or should it be changed, and can we realistically feed the United States of America in an inexpensive way without industrial farming that we're talking about now? We're going to tackle that issue when we return here. Join us with your thoughts. How do you buy your food? What kind of food do you buy? Do you care about these things when you look for the food you buy in your corner store or in your local supermarket? The number here is 410-319-8888. And I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show's partner, our print partner, is The Urbanite. And this April, the Urbanite issue is the green issue, and this is one of those green stories. The show's topic was inspired by an interview you can read in this month's Urbanite. It was an interview with Vandana Shiva, an Indian environmental activist who says the industrialized West is literally consuming the developing world by pushing industrial agriculture methods on once traditional agrarian societies. You can read this article at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. We'll talk about that and more when we return, so stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We are joined this hour by Dr. Robert Lawrence, who's director of the Center for a Livable Future at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Pamela Ronald is a plant pathologist and joins us from the University of California, Davis, where she works. She and her husband, who's an organic farmer, wrote the book Tomorrow's Table, Organic Farming, Genetics, and the Future of Food. Dr. Robert Young. Bob Young is an economist at the American Farm Bureau, the largest farm organization in the United States that works to protect the interests of farmers and ranchers. Your thoughts at 410-319-8888. We're going to talk about whether there needs to be a change in U.S. agricultural policy. If there does, how do we get there? Or should we just leave it alone and let it go where it goes? Let me start with a listener who can set that conversation off, I think. 410-319-8888. And Lovey, you're on the air. Hi, Lovey, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, what I was saying was that for the past 2 years, I've become an avid label reader of the foods that I'm purchasing for my kids and I. You know, this topic is very informative, you know, everything that you guys are talking about. But, yeah, it's really important that everybody start reading labels and, you know, just reading the things that are going into the foods that we're eating.
And I think you raised the issue that we can lead us kind of into a conversation here before we go to our next caller. And that's the issue of the what's really going to change policy in America, if in fact it should be changed, is the agriculture bill that comes up in 4 more years.
Uh-huh.
It was passed in the last year. So the question is, I want to ask for our guests and to what Lovey was saying, I mean, is our agricultural policy in America skewed towards industrial farming and animal growth as opposed to feeding and the United States, and can and should it change? I mean, and some people would argue, no, this is a system that has fed America now for a long time with inexpensive food, and for us to change it would be pure folly. Let me start with Bob Young and then go around the room.
Well, I think, again, when you recognize that the farm program designs we have in place today, in large part, where most of the money's going at this point in time, was put in place with very much with the notion of what our international trade commitments happen to be. The direct payment programs, for example, that are provided to producers are the kinds of programs that Europe and Australia and most other countries around the world said, this is what we would like you to move to. And from an economic standpoint, are also fairly efficient at making those transfers, at providing those protections without getting into the marketplace and distorting the marketplace. So in that sense, I think they're very efficient at what they do. Now, understand that they are geared toward crops that, if you will, that are kind of the base on which the rest of the agricultural system is built on. They are the base for the livestock sector, for example, whether it be cattle or dairy or whatever. They are, these are the feed inputs for those sectors. They're also the feed inputs or the industrial input for as we've talked about already, on ethanol or any number of other industrial inputs as well. So they are kind of a base system, if you will. They don't provide, and historically they've not provided protection for fruits and vegetable crops, although in the last farm bill, the fruit and vegetable sector did end up with a pretty substantial boost in their support out of the farm bill this last time.
So Bob Lawrence, if you are going to challenge American agricultural policy, and I'd like to hear what Pamela Ronald thinks about what you're saying, and also Bob Young, and go to our next caller, who's Ralph. Hold on, and let you get your thoughts about this. But what if you were challenging, if you were changing the idea of how we do agricultural policy in America and could actually feed the people, because I think there's no real data that sustainable agriculture, sustainable organic agriculture, can feed.
And Mark, again, I think the point that Pamela made earlier on, that the notion that it has to be organic in order to be sustainable, is just a real fallacy, because I think we have been very sustainable and can demonstrate that we've made significant environmental improvements in conventional production systems over the course of the last 15, 20 years. So.
Well, and I've been reading about farmers who are trying to do things in a sustainable way and not using the pesticides, but they do use a few pesticides to kill off to kill off weeds and certain pests, but they try to do it in a way that is modeled on old agriculture, and they're having a hard time surviving as well because of that, because nobody considers their food as healthy as organic, those who want to eat it.
That organic, whatever, however you're farming, you got to provide food for the plant, you got to take care of the weeds, you got to take care of the bugs. And organic agriculture takes care of weeds basically by tilling the soil, by turning over the soil. And by breaking open that soil, you do and actually talk about significant increases in carbon output. You know, there are some reasons why you want to think very hard about that particular approach. I'm not anything against it. You know, I think it's as a lifestyle choice, it's fine. But just understand that there are some complications there.
Bob Lawrence?
Well, first of all, Bob Young has twice talked about lifestyle choices. We're talking about survival choices, not lifestyle.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that the way in which industrial agriculture now runs is unsustainable post-peak oil, post-peak water. 40 years ago, sub-Saharan Africa.
Bob, let me just finish.
One at a time. Bob Lawrence finished, and we'll come back young and bring Pamela back in as well.
40 years ago, of the 31 sub-Saharan African countries, all but one were food exporting. Their ability to continue to feed their own people has been dramatically reduced. Now all 31 are food importing.
And you're laying the blame where and why?
I'm laying blame in two places. First of all, a lot of the subsistence agriculture was converted to cash cropping. So that Senegal, for example, which once had an export policy with a variety of different fruits and vegetables and grains, was essentially converted into a monocrop culture of peanuts to produce cooking oil for France. And that story goes across the whole sub-Saharan African continent. I think that Bob Young's comment that the commodity support has not distorted markets is really untrue. We have a trade policy now that's called free trade. It's really what we need to do is change it from free trade to fair trade. India was forced by the WTO to change its domestic food subsidy program. So now companies, international agribusiness companies like PepsiCo, can purchase grain in India for $85 to $90 a ton. And an Indian baker who's trying to get his basic ingredients in order to produce bread to feed his fellow Indians has to pay $120 to $130 a ton. The system is broken. The reason food is so cheap in the United States is that a lot of the true costs have been externalized. Environmental degradation, the problems of pollution, et cetera. So I really think we need to take a accurate look at what are the inputs, what are the outputs, and how many of them are dependent on cheap oil, abundant water, and an attitude toward the environment that we can do to it what we want.
Now, before we turn to Pamela Arnold, Bobby, how would you argue against that?
Well, you know, I think when you understand that the great, great bulk, and you know this, Bob, the great, great bulk of agricultural production in the United States is rain-fed. It's not irrigated. So, you know, unless we're going to say that the rain's going to stop tomorrow, you know, I don't understand how we think that that ends up being an unsustainable practice.
Well, the best estimates for climate change are that we're going to have more extreme weather events. We're going to have periods of drought and flood replace that consistent rainfall that has been a true wonder of the Midwest and its productivity. We will not be able to continue having 80% of our row crops go to feed animals before we have them feed humans.
So the question is, though, and I wonder, hearing this argument, Pamela, Ronald, I'm going to go to the phones right after your comment, is should agricultural policy be changed and how? I mean, I think we've outlined from the two Bobs here very different views of American agricultural policy.
Yes, we need to change agricultural policy, and we're poised to do that right now with the financial crises going on and the food crises going on and the greater awareness of the need to take better care of our planet. So what I want to see is the broader goals stated in the Farm Bill and the goals that I mentioned before. So we need to feed the poor and malnourished. We need to reduce environmental inputs. We need to preserve genetic diversity. We need economic sustainability, which often means we need high yield. And we need the food to be safe and nutritious. And the interesting thing is most people will agree on those goals. The question is, how do we get there? And I think Bob Lawrence brought up a really interesting point, is that this issue of language when we talk about agriculture, it really is a disaster. I mean, I think the public sometimes doesn't even know what us so-called experts are talking about when we say genetic modification or genetic engineering or conventional versus industrial. And as all we all know, organic has gone industrial. So if you say the first 7,000 years are conventional and that's where we want to be versus modern agriculture, which is industrial, well, then you're lumping organic in with industrial. So that's something perhaps we can talk about. And I think it gets in the way of the point that we need a very efficient and ecologically based agriculture.
And that's a question, so how do we get there? In other words, if we change that policy, if policies begin to change, what would happen to the agricultural industry in America? Because I think what you said, Pamela or Ronald, is completely correct, which is that the organic farming is going industrial. When you go to any store, whether it's a Whole Foods store or your local Giant or whatever your local supermarket is, and you go to the organic shelf, those bottles of milk are mass-produced. They're not produced by the farmer who lives out in Baltimore County or if you're living in whatever urban area around there. They're produced somewhere else and brought in. So,
yeah, and
go ahead.
I was just going to say the fact that it's industrial. And if we think of industrial as being grown on a very large scale and very efficiently, that's not necessarily negative, right? What the negative aspects are is if we're using pesticides that are contributed to pesticide-related poisonings, or if we're not locally producing food security in places that need it. And this is really where genetics can play a huge, huge part. So I was recently involved in a project where we developed a submergence-tolerant rice. And again, as one of the guests mentioned, as we move into the future, it's expected to have more flooding, more drought. And my collaborators at the International Rice Research Institute introduced essentially a single gene into rice varieties that are favored by people in Bangladesh and India. Those farmers saw a 3 to 5-fold increase in yield. And these people live on less than a dollar a day. So that is really bringing local food security. And that's why we need to use modern genetics, because there are just incredible things that we can do now with the advent of massive sequencing and modern genetic methods.
And Bob Lawrence, before we turn back to Bob Young, and I know that we can spend a whole other hour on whether organics should go genetics, and I think we should because it's at the crux of the debate that I think is going to start taking place, and Pamela Ronald's on the cutting edge of that debate.
But I just interrupt one minute just to say that all organic farmers rely on genetically improved seed. So, for example, there are very few organic farmers that do their own breeding. They're purchasing seed from for-profit companies that have used conventional breeding to develop new varieties. So all farmers are completely reliant on genetics already.
So, Bob Lawrence, talk about, and I'd like to hear Bob Young respond, talk about then how you would change, what were the things you would argue with our congresspeople to change the farm bill? How would you begin to make the change?
Well, first of all, I would begin to really take seriously the commodity subsidies and the way in which they have distorted U.S. food availability.
You're talking about subsidizing large wholesale grain?
$20 billion for the corn, wheat, soy, cotton, sugar.
And replace it how?
Well, first of all, that artificially distorts the consumer's perception of what's affordable in the grocery store. Because if you're subsidizing animal feed, then it's a bonanza for the industrial food animal producers who are raising 8 billion animals a year, selling chicken at an incredibly low price in the consumer's eyes, which doesn't have a big sign on it saying this was subsidized by $20 billion of commodity support.
So before we turn to Bob Young, I really want to get this straight so Bob can respond and see if we can get some of this done before the end of the hour.
Yeah.
So if you change the way we subsidize agriculture from your perspective, that would mean, A, that less corn, soy, cotton,
sugar.
And sugar are produced. Which would mean that...
No, they'd be produced at market rates. They just wouldn't be subsidized.
It would also mean that the steak, chicken, and pork that we buy in the store...
Would
poultry,
get more expensive.
Would be more expensive.
Right.
So how do you sell... So why would we want to do that? I mean, so A, why would we want to do that, and B, what replaces it, is what I want to know. And then I want to hear Bob Young's take.
Well, people won't want to do it necessarily. It'll be better for their health. It'll reduce the amount of saturated fat in the diet. It would bring us into closer conformity to the USDA's recommended daily allowance of animal protein. It would be a less pressure on an already overstretched food production system globally, because if we take some of that demand pressure off the production of animal feeds, we free up acreage for producing fruits and vegetables. Right now, if all of us ate the recommended 5 portions a day of fruits and vegetables, we don't have enough acreage in the United States to produce that. So we're in a terrible situation where so much of our, for example, in Iowa, 29 million acres of land in Iowa, 98% of it is in corn and soy. 30 years ago, Iowa was producing 31 or 32 economically viable crops, fruits, vegetables, grains, for consumption within Iowa, for export throughout the United States. We have grossly distorted the system. We can bring it back, but it's going to take sacrifices. We're going to have to eat lower on the hog. There's no two ways about it.
Lower on the hog, which means less hog.
Less
I don't
hog
know about lower on the hog.
The hog.
Some of that lower part I don't think I want anyway, but... Bob Young, let me ask this question. If you took what Bob Lawrence is saying and shift in the debate our agricultural policy to what Bob Lawrence is suggesting, what do you think that would do?
Well, first off, I think Bob's got some of his numbers wrong. I don't remember that we've got 29 billion acres of...
29 million.
Million. He said million, not billion. Million. Million.
And we're not spending $20 billion on farm programs at this point in time, and we haven't for some time, as a matter of fact, as well. So, you know, I think we need to make sure we've got our numbers straight before we go a lot further on that front. You know, I have no doubt that if you were to talk about removing farm program supports, again, farmers face tremendous risks. They face risks every time they decide to go out and put the crop in the ground, and they are kind of the eternal optimist. And so if you were to talk about removing those safety nets, if you will, you know, then because of the added risk, you're probably going to get folks to decide they don't want to do quite as much as they were doing before. I have always viewed farm programs as an insurance policy. If governments are going to be involved in agricultural production and in food systems, and you know, I don't know of too many countries on the planet that don't, Even New Zealand and Australia have government involvement in their farm program or in their agriculture and their food system. You really kind of want that government to make sure it's got a bushel too much, don't you? And if they're going to have a bushel too much, then that means prices are going to be lower than they otherwise would be. It's an insurance policy, pay the premium. And I don't think we've done very bad at all with the insurance policy that we've had in the United States agriculture and the United States food system over the course of the last 50, 60 years. You know, we're paying about 10% or so, spending about 10% or so of our income on food for the nation as a whole. Various income groups, you know, are going to pay more. Some are going to pay a little bit less. And I don't know that that's a bad deal. You're pretty hard-pressed to find another country on the planet that spends as little on food as we do in the United States. I think that's a pretty good deal.
Now, Pamela, I don't know if you were sneezing or making a comment there.
That was a sneeze, but okay. I'm glad you
just checking. Well, good tonight. But I
thank you.
So the question becomes, I mean, I think there really is a difference here about whether or not we need to change the face of agriculture in America, which I think is an important discussion for us to have. We just touched the beginning of it this hour. And how would you weigh in on this? And how would you rewrite that farm bill if it should be written?
Again, I would go back to the goals. What are the goals? And then I don't think we simply cannot legislate farming practices or breeding practices without taking the goals in mind. So, and I'd like to get back to the question on the telephone, which was a really good question about labeling. So I'm also a label reader. I love to read labels. And I think it would be very fantastic to have very comprehensive labels. So, for example, barcodes, as some people have mentioned before. So instead of saying conventionally grown, organically grown, GMO seed, I mean, that is not information that the consumer can use. What we really need to have are barcodes that say how much land is used, how much insecticide is used, how much water is used. And that, again, will address the issues that I think all three of us agree that need to be addressed.
So going back to where we were a moment ago, and I was trying to look up the arguments around the cost of agricultural subsidies. And I mean, one website I found does say that U.S. farm programs cost about $20 billion a year.
They did a few years ago, but over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, we've been down in the $12 billion range.
Bob Lawrence?
Per annum. I was using $20 billion over the 5 year of the 2008 farm bill. Whether I think the problem is that that subsidy, and Bob Young is right, U.S. is not unique in that. We have European subsidies, we have Australian subsidies, but what that does to the low-income and lower-middle-income countries of the world, it destroys the market for small farmers. They simply cannot compete on the global commodity market. And so part of the problem of malnutrition, hunger, and so forth is the fact that we have, through processes that have artificially depressed the price of food in the United States, because yes, we do spend only 10% of our disposable income on food in the U.S., but that's because, as I said earlier, a lot of the true costs have been externalized. In the state of North Carolina, there are 26 river systems. 23 of them are polluted by the hog industry. And how do you put a price tag on that? How much is it worth to have a cheap pork chop if you can no longer fish in the Neuse River, or if you have gross contamination of surface waters by ruptured cesspits from these giant hog facilities? Those are the costs that are not captured at the marketplace. And we have to figure out a way of really having the polluter pay, reflect that in the cost of food. And then suddenly, the economic incentives for people going into the store and buying fruits and vegetables or whole grains is going to shift in that direction and away from the artificially cheap meat that dominates the dinner table today.
I want to ask you, as we're kind of running through time here, out of time, if we were to shift the way Bob Lawrence is suggesting, I'd like all three of you here to start very quickly with Bob Young, then than Pam and Ronald, each in about 30 seconds, and then go to Bob Lawrence. What would happen to the agriculture industry in America, and how would it change? Bob Young?
I don't know that it would shift all that much, but I do think everything that Bob's been talking about has been talking about raising the price of food to the consumer. And I can recall any number of shows that I was on last year where everybody was deeply concerned about that. And so it just surprises me that we're at this stage of the game and saying that that's the policy we want to move to.
Pamela Ronald?
Well, I think where we are going to move, and if the policies are changed as suggested, what we're going to see is more genetically engineered crops grown using the best available farming practices, and that will include using less insecticides and less pesticides and introducing no-till. And genetics is the most economically and efficient way to get there. So already organic produce is selling less because people don't have the money to buy expensive food. But we need to incorporate those practices.
Pam, I'm sorry, we are out of time, so I'll even have a chance to let my colleague here, friend Bob Lawrence, give a final word in, but we'll come back to the subject. Bob Lawrence, Pamela Ronald, and Bob Young, thank you all so much for being with us during the course of this hour.
Thank you.
And
we want to thank the Tom Creek Foundation for funding our series on sustainability and reminding you that part of the show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine. You can go there and see the green issue right now and find it at over 800 locations. Go to www.urbanitebaltimore.com to continue our discussions on the future of our planet. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Mike Nice. Thanks to Ali Bauer at UC Davis for her help in engineering this hour. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, and Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, hear new interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.